understand how important it is to memorize. So we're at James lesson 4. And really, it's about not being deceived. If you looked at the rest of James, you will notice that deceive, delude, deception is in there several times. And one of the reasons we're spending a lot of time on James, even beyond my comfort zone, is because James 1 is the thesis for the whole letter. So if you get James 1 well, the rest is just simple ways to work it out. So there's nothing new, actually, in James 2, 3, 4, and 5, except for just simple ways of what it looks like to be an integrated whole that is participating in the perichoretic life. And I think Laura did a very great job of kind of reviewing for us how we think about that and what that looks like. So that's why we're going over James so often. I also asked you this week to be noticing your shame stories. How many of you did that? So anybody willing to share anything that they noticed? You don't have to share specific if you don't want, but just like the amount that you noticed or how often or when you noticed it. Great, Lisa.
It's not a big deal, but it's almost silly, but it's somewhat revealing. I went on errand to REI to pick up some things, and I was to bring my gift card. And when I get there, I look over in the seat where I thought I put it. The gift card's sitting at home. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so stupid, I'm so forgetful, I like heart rate racing, I like went like just mad going to the store. I was so flustered. I like took off my coat, I was sweating. I'm like, oh my gosh. And I someone asked me something, I'm like, I can't think right now, I'm flustered. And then I just was like, oh my gosh, this is my, part of my shame story. I'm forgetful. I had to do like 3 laps around the store to kind of calm down. And say, okay. And I forgot to connect to God. I did connect to an employee. I'm like, can you please help me? I don't know what kind of gloves to buy. But I felt like at least I connected. But I'm like, I'm forgetful and I'm stupid. That was my shame story.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, and the other thing, there's another thing I've noticed too. When I'm not forgetful, I'm not forgetful. I'm prideful. Is that true?
Yes.
Yep.
So I was like, oh my gosh, this is all starting to make sense.
Yes.
Yay. And so,
yeah, yeah. Can you relate, Cindy?
Yeah, you know, you talked about this last week, but when you're faced with something that goes against what you believe or what you think, especially like on Facebook, and there's a particular person that's generating that, of course I ran into that person at the grocery store and gave her a hug. And she has no idea my feelings about it, but I gave her a hug because of what we had been learning.
Yes.
And it was a beautiful interchange. Yes. We talked about our children, and I completely forgot about all that other stuff that I had created in my head.
Right, right.
To be...
What would have been your normal response?
I probably still would have done that, but the reality of the beauty of the connection would not have been there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It would have just been a response out of duty instead of... Yeah. Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. There's a big difference between that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, God, you brought her right here in my face.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
so, exactly. Yeah. That's good. Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. This is like kind of a question/an observation. Like, I don't know, but I feel like kind of stuck in this. So when I started thinking about a shame story, so I've noticed that like I feel shame a lot, but I can't quite trace back where it has started and like why I feel that way. And so I've noticed this week, I noticed I really got stuck in some places of being like, but I, and maybe this is just me personally wanting to know like where exactly that happened, like and what started that pattern, because I think I can trace generally like where that came from, but it's like different instances bring up different things, and there's like all these different almost like rivers of places and in different like situations. So I don't know, that was like a weird observation I made of being like, I still haven't quite figured out. Maybe that's me just to like psychoanalyze it a little too much of being like, well, wait, wow, like where did this start? And like, why am I being so affected by these shame stories in like this specific instance? And then it like, and I'm realizing by not really knowing where that is and understanding where it came from, I still can't. the shame story is being affected by. Because I can't fully, like, wrap my head around it, mm-hmm. because I want to disconnect. I want to disconnect from relationships mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I think my shame stories just kind of, like, keep feeding that. And by not being able to figure out kind of, like, where it has come from, mm-hmm. I can't connect quite yet.
So I think that's a good observation. And I think, Karen, what's really true is if we aren't doing some work on that, it does compile. It does happen. We're actually going to talk about that. That those shame stories, if we don't reveal some of them, they will continue to compile because that's the only way we know how to live. It's been instilled in us. And you and I can talk because, like, I know where some of your shame stories come from. So we don't need to know specifically. What I have found for myself is when I think about the first thing that you need to notice is that you have a contextual language that you use more than others, right? And that should be the first thing you start to notice. So you work backwards. And when I notice that my contextual language, a lot like you, Lisa, is I'm so stupid. I say that a lot. Then I'm thinking, so my contextual language is I have two. One is being good and one is being smart. And I think about why smart? Was there anything in my childhood that was always about you have to be smart? And I could start to think of some instances about grades. You know, my mother was adamant that she would not reward us for A's because that was what we were supposed to do, mm-hmm. but we would get punished if we got anything less. Mm-hmm. So that really fed into that, right? And so then I'm thinking, why was that such a big deal for her? Mm-hmm. And then I realize my mom was, did I tell you this story before? Mm-hmm. My mom was very smart. She skipped a grade. But remember, she ran away at 15 and got married, mm-hmm. which means she never graduated high school. Mm-hmm. Where's her shame?
Yeah.
That's part of her shame, right? Mm-hmm. So part of her shame was involved in you have to get A's and you have to do well and you have to go to college. Mm-hmm. Do you see that?
Yeah.
So it's a backing up thing. But it sometimes takes a while. Obviously, I've been working on this for several months, just thinking through some of that stuff. It's why I had you do the life maps a couple mm-hmm. semesters mm-hmm. ago to help you. There's all sorts of ways to look at it. But it is important that we start. We don't have to know the specific instance. But we do have to. It's important that we understand our shame responses are connected to the contextual languages that we use the most often. Just start noticing your own language patterns, and you'll begin to see that. Remember when Karen was so vulnerably sharing everything, and every one of you said, "Oh, there's her contextual language." You could hear it in her speech. Mm-hmm. That's all of us. Mm-hmm. So notice particularly when you're upset, mm-hmm. or afraid, or in those places. Notice that, and then work backwards from that. Yes, it'll take a while. You don't have to know the specific, where did this happen? Because it's not a specific, remember, it's an accumulation of practices over and over again. So I think that's a good question, Karen. Anybody else have any comments on that?
I can share.
Yeah.
I definitely have found that my contextual language is being good, being right, that exercise. I wasn't here that day, but a memory from every grade, I mean, that was just like blaring to me, you know, because almost everything was, you know, a time I was bad. I was a bad girl or whatever. And so last week I had to teach Leviticus to the high school students. And I don't like teaching. I don't like preparing for teaching. I'll like do my duty every semester and try to come up with something. And, you know, sometimes when you're teaching people, you might have some eye contact, maybe not. Maybe people are smiling. Maybe everybody's looking at you glossy-eyed. And I want to be liked. I want to be a good Christian. And when I was done, I didn't feel good about it. And I didn't talk to anyone at the end, and I just ran out. And I didn't think anyone was going to come up to me and say, "Oh, that sucked," you know. These are high school kids. That's how they talk. But I I didn't want to stand there and not have anyone say, you did a great job. Mm-hmm. So I just ran out.
So that's how you felt, you said.
Yeah.
Several
right.
lessons back.
Right.
You didn't think you connected with us.
Yeah. Yeah. So all that to say, we all have these, and we all have them all the time, mm-hmm. multiple times in the day. Mm-hmm. And I want us to keep on digging in that, mainly because when we go through James and James says these are the things you should do, if you don't dig into your own shame responses and the fact that you have contextual languages, you will look at that as an obligation. Like Cindy said, it'll be an obligation. We'll just do it. And that is a disintegration of your being. That is, that's asking for wisdom and then putting that aside for just certain places, certain times, so that I just have to do this. So it's never, doing never comes out of duty and still be whole. So it has to come out of this intimate, vulnerable relationship. Otherwise, it's not what God is asking us of. And it's not making you whole. It's making you compartmentalized. So it's important for you to do this. It's important for all of us to do this. And it takes work. And it takes a different kind of work than doing your workbook. And I would so much rather you do this kind of work. I don't know who it was. I'm trying to think of somebody. Somebody listened to the lesson or something that's never been class and said, your class is kind of like a therapy class. Yeah, it kind of is. Which is really funny because originally that was my, that's what I was, that's what I went to school for and did it 1 week and hated it. So I think, well, isn't that funny? I just do it in a different way, just by teaching. So anyway, if that's what it is, that's what it is. I think that's where James is going. So just quickly review, remember our minds are embodied processes. They're actually meant to be growing. They're not full, complete. And they grow through three things. They grow through attention. They grow through, this should be on your notes, right? Mm-hmm. Attention, attachment, and integration, which leads to a telos of joy. And why that's so important is because joy is what allows us to be free enough to be able to be creative persons, to be able to be creative image bearers, priests, who name and tend and make space for others. So without an integrated mind that is being paid attention to from outside and from inside, that is has a secure attachment, and that becomes integrated because of those attention and attachment, without that, I cannot be whole, and I can't name and tend and make space for others. So I can't be an image-bearing priest. So it's really important. So our mind, the way our mind works, tells us the way we're supposed to work in our whole life. And then we talked about stories, the fact that stories form us. And they form us through those shame responses that have been passed down as embodied stories. Remember, they weren't, you didn't get, put in chairs and in desks, and your parents didn't say, look, this is how we're going to deal with shame in our lives. It's just comes as an embodied, and they don't know they're passing it down. You as parents don't know you're passing it down, but you are. And one of the things that we need to understand is James doesn't really want us to know about shame so we feel bad. He doesn't want us to know about shame so that we're shamed. He wants us to know about shame so that we deal with it properly, right? So that we use it in the way it's meant to be used rather than allowing it to drag us down. So the fact that we all pass down shame responses, you shouldn't walk out going, oh man, this is horrible. You should go out going, wow, now I know how I work. So now I have ways of seeing the world and relationships and my life in a different way so that I can see it from God's way.
How do you move past that?
Well, that's what part of James is going to do, right? So we're getting through that, how we move past that. And I'm actually not too worried about you not moving past it yet, because I don't want it to be a thing that says, oh, I just got to get through this and done. This is important. This is really important for us to know about shame. And for James, And Robin, I'm kind of answering your question. Why do we know that James is a book that's talking about shame? Because he doesn't really ever say this is shameful or this is not shameful. But remember that he's in an honor-shame society, which up until recently, America has not been considered an honor-shame society, but we've switched into that, which is an interesting thing. So in my lifetime, it's changed from a guilt society to a shame society, an honor-shame. But we know specifically James is talking about that because he's in an honor-shame society and he's talking about the poor. And the poor are the people who feel the most amount of shame. And the rich are absolutely trying to wall off shame. And so there's this separation of poor and rich. So that's why we know that James is really concerned about this idea of shame and allowing it to form you and allowing the stories of shame to form you. So we know that shame, the stories form us. We also know that the shame responses are stories that have been passed down to us and that we're doing the same thing. But we also need to know there's really only two stories. There's God's story and there's Satan's story. And God's story says, you are connected and beloved. And not only that, but I'm delighting in you and I'm delighting in being with you. And I'm delighting in you being able to be my representative. I delight in that. That is God's story. I cringe often that we sometimes in the evangelical world, when we say God's story, we start with, you're a sinner,
yeah.
and God has a great plan for your life. Mm-hmm. That's not God's story. Yeah. God's story is, you are beloved, mm-hmm. and I have chosen to be with you. And I want you to be with you. I want to be with you. Mm-hmm. That's God's story. Satan's story is that one. Satan's story is you're on your own, man. And you are an independent creature and you get to decide how you are going to be valued in this world. But it's all about you. And it's about you striving to get valued in this world. And that obviously if you're going to strive to get value in this world, that you are earning your value. That's Satan's story. And we've got to be very clear about that. We've got to be very clear, particularly when we're sharing the gospel, because we share Satan's story so much that it's not a surprise that people are like, well, that's the story I know. I mean, I know that story already. I'm not good enough. And that's what we've been sharing a lot, right? You're a sinner and you need God. So you're not enough. And therefore, you got to get enough. So, of course, there's going to come out all sorts of, oh. And then we have people who say they're Christians, and really their life looks like striving. And that's why. Because we're not telling God's story. We're telling Satan's story. And sometimes I think we just need to be very blunt about that. Because I think we've been very cavalier about the stories that we're sharing. So we need to know there's only two, and those are the two. But we can reform our stories. So our stories, we've had this shame story. Satan's thrilled about having our shame story, and he's thrilled about letting you go ahead and have behavior that looks good, but it's all trying to get your contextual language done because he knows he's got you. You're working under a shame story rather than under a beloved story. Why I picked this my new verse here. I have loved you with an everlasting love. That's who you are. So before you ever come to, these are the things you need to do, you need to start there. And that's how James starts. Remember, he starts with his relationship with Jesus Christ and joy. He says it twice in his greeting. Greetings, joy, he says. And that's where we need to start. But it can be, our shame stories can be reformed. By being intentionally vulnerable. And what are you going to find about this? Our minds are worked by attention, attachment, and integration. Everything that James talks about will have those three ingredients, starting with vulnerability. You have to be vulnerable to that, with an admission of lack, with the possibility that an other has something that you don't have, and then paying attention, knowing what fuels you, what's fueling you, what fuel is propelling you, and that odd thing I said, to befriend your inner enemies, those enemies of anger and frustration, by naming them, by saying, oh, this is a feeling that's a warning. So I don't think I've ever heard it taught anywhere that we need to name that feeling, but name it for what it is. It's a warning. So a feeling of anger is a warning. We need to name that, and then we need to tend that then. If it's a warning, I need to heed the warning, right? That's the tending. Let it do its job rather than make it something it isn't. We'll talk a little bit more about anger as we get into the lesson today. One of the other reasons we need to know our shame story is because when we know our shame stories, it creates empathy for others. If we don't know our shame stories, we're judgers. We look at the other person and we say, they're always angry, they're critical, they're mean, they're this or that, they're doing the wrong thing. But if we know our shame stories and we see someone who acts out their anger or who is unfriendly or is always looking out for themselves, we look at that and we go, oh, I know how that feels. I do that too. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If I know my shame story, then I have empathy for others. I meant to bring it down. There's, do you know who Abraham Heschel is? He's one of the leading rabbis. He used to be, I don't remember what they call the leading rabbi. Anyways, the leading rabbi in England, so he's still writing. He writes about this man who made all sorts of laws and things, you know, against Jewish people, and, you know, that they were, and basically he stereotyped them until one day he found out that he was actually Jewish. And then all of a sudden, it completely changed his way of looking at things, right? Well, that's the idea with our shame stories. So that every time we see somebody acting in a way we disapprove of, if I haven't been involved in my own shame story, I will judge them and say, well, they're a bad person. They're a them. But if I'm involved in my shame story, the first thing I do is look at them and say, I wonder what shame they're operating under. So, which is why I can look at my mom, who never said, I love you, who didn't give me words and all these things. I can look at her with empathy to know what her, I know some of her shame stories. I know a lot of them, and they're horrible. And I have no animosity toward my mother at all. I feel like devastated for her. And I could, when I think about it, it doesn't bother me that she never said that. And we'll talk about more like, oh, now I began to see places she did say I love you in ways that she could out of that. Who had a question?
I was just going to make a comment about, it's lately I've been watching other drivers, especially in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I kind of go, I drive like I do sometimes. And you just start to understand what could possibly be going on. And so it's always just interesting being in the back seat.
Yes.
Somebody else is driving who's in the car next to you.
Right, right.
So God makes me giggle that way too.
Yeah. I mean, it makes us then not look at other people as them, right? Yeah. Oh, that's us. That's me. That's me. Boy, I get that. And then your interaction with them is very different, right? It's no longer this wall of an us and them. And that's kind of what you encountered, right? Exactly that. So there's several reasons we need to know our shame stories. Those are two. I'll probably tell you at least one more. But in order to reform our own stories, we need to be vulnerable, we need to pay attention, and we need to seek attachment. And that's, we had just begun that by asking. Remember, what asking means is this practice of vulnerability, of being open to another, that another might have something you don't have. In fact, it's not a might, it is. They do have something you don't have, and that you, would actually make you more whole. To be able to give to you. It's funny that asking for us is so difficult. And I thought about this. I thought, okay, James is telling us asking should be a practice. So it's something we actually intentionally do. And we start by asking God because whatever I practice with God, it actually leaks into my life, right? That practice with others. And I thought, so what would be the difference? What do I do when I get up? What's the first thing you do when you get up in the morning? Okay, and that's for A types like me. What's the first thing I do? I think through my list of what I have to do today, right? So for me, I said, so what does asking as a practice look like? Well, it's getting rid of that, right? And sometimes I'm laying in bed. Okay, I got it. Okay, I got that. Rather, it's, for me, it would be, God, no matter what is here today, could you allow me to participate in that perichoretic life so that I get to understand what it's like to be with others, so that I understand, learn a new way of being. And that's that asking, being open, like I'm going to start the day open instead of I'm starting the day with my agenda. As soon as I do that, right, I'm going to fall into my contextual languages because my agenda means I'm going to get that done because to get that done will fulfill some of my being smart or being good or whatever. But the wisdom being the connection with that perichoretic relationship, that ability to learn a new way of being with one another. Mm-hmm. How many of you watch HGTV, all the house shows? There's a couple. If we had time, I would show you two sets of them. There's two different programs. I'm sure you've heard at least one of them. One's called Flip or Flop, and one's called Fixer Upper. Okay, those are the two leading home shows out right now.
Love or List It.
Love or List It, but that's a little different. But right. It would fall into these. But Flip or Flop and Fixer Upper. Oh. On the surface, they look the same. They're both a married couple, flipping houses, redesigning houses. One couple, the Flip or Flop, what is in focus is they buy the worst house, they fix it up, and what you see is the two of them together, and you see their interactions together.
Isn't that the brothers?
No, that's Property Brothers. you see the two of them interact, and there's always a little bit of an argument, you know, and usually the wife gets her way, and then at the end they're trying to decide how much are they going to list it for, and the very end thing that you have, so you know where the tellus is how much they made, right? Okay, so you have that. And then you have Fixer Upper. Fixer Upper does the same thing. They're a husband and wife couple. And they go in and they find a really dilapidated house, but they do it for a specific person rather than do it to sell it. So they do it for a specific person with them in mind. They have a consultation with them. And then they show it at the end and show the family at the end enjoying it. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of differences there. We can go into a lot of those because they show kind of the differences. But here's what has struck me. The interaction between the two couples mm-hmm. is so different. Mm-hmm. The Flip or Flop is, like I said, they're not mean to each other, but they're, you know, there's this, and you can see it's all about what's going to make us the most money. Mm-hmm. The other one, Fixer Upper, this is, and you've heard the name if you haven't heard the show, Chip and Joanna Gaines. The way they interact with, mm-hmm. I've never seen people on TV interact with one another in this way, because everything they do with one another. So Chip is really silly. And he's he does goofy things, and Joanna she always says, Chip, you're so cute. Chip, I just love you. Just it's so the way they interact. Why I bring this up, because watching them as opposed to the other couple, who by the way are already now divorced.
Oh wow.
Watching them gives me a way of being with another. It shows me a model of a way to be with one another. They're doing the exact same thing these people are doing. They want to do their best. They want to make it absolutely gorgeous. But in the process, first of all, they always bring their family along. Their family helps. So they have four little kids. They always show their home. They always show them interacting with lots of animals. They have, you know, they've got a farm with thousands of animals. But the way they interact with one another. So I bring that up because when I'm asking for wisdom, I'm asking for a way of being with another. Show me an example, God. Show me. Let me participate. And that's what happens in the show. You get to participate in their life. You see what their kids are like. You see the kids working together. You see that. They let us participate in their life. And in so, I get to see a way of being that then gives a different freedom than the other. Does that give you an idea? That's kind of where we're looking for wisdom. So that in that, we get the freedom then to be able to be creative in our tending, in our naming, in our making space. When he gives himself generously, we feel his joy. And this kind of giving is showing what life can be like when I'm living in a way of being with another. Like, that's my focus. They both turn out absolutely gorgeous houses. If that's all you're evaluating, I personally like the other houses better. I'm not a rustic farm person. But that's not what we're evaluating in life, right? That's not what we're supposed to be evaluating. It is that, how are we connecting with one another? So the question we need to ask is, how do I connect with those people who are different than me? I don't want to know how you and I connect here. It's important, but we pretty much know how to connect with somebody who's like us. Mm-hmm. How do we connect with the homeless man that we walk past on the street? Or the punky kid who just, hit your car? Or do we treat them as kin? Do we want to have that kind of a connection with them? Do we give ourselves fully like God gives fully to us? That when I'm asking for wisdom, I'm asking for another example. God, give me participation in the pericritic life that I can see what it's like to be with another like me. The fact that God gives himself fully to us who are constantly disconnecting from him should inform us about how we connect with people who we think are disconnected to us. And giving ourselves fully. So I have a story. Our pastor's wife grew up in Brazil, and she told a story a couple weeks ago about her mom. So her mom was walking to the market one day, and she got held up by someone by gunpoint. And I just laugh. It told me so much about Catherine and who she married. So think about this. You're being held up by someone. So what's the first instance you're thinking of is, okay, that's a them, right? That's someone who is being mean to me. He's dangerous. And my first thought is, I need to keep myself safe, right? Okay, so I'm working out of contextual language there. And that's really hard for us. Because when I bring things up like this, people say, well no, wait a second. Jesus never says, don't protect yourself. Well, actually, he does. But we don't want to believe that. So this is what Catherine's mom does. The guy's holding a gun to her head, and she does this. Young man. She puts her hand on his shoulder. Young man, why are you doing this? What's going on in your life? I'm not kidding you. What is going on in your life? Why are you doing something like this? And the man said, I've lost my job, and I have a whole family to feed, and I have no way to feed them. And she said, what do you do? What kind of a work do you do? And he said, I'm a baker. And she said, well, did you try down the street, that bakery down the street? They've actually been looking for work. Have you tried that? Mm-hmm. I don't know what he answered, but she said, listen. And she took out pen and a paper. She writes her phone number, and she gives it to him. And she says, now listen, here are a couple leads I want to give you. This place, I want you to look at these places because I think that they might be able to hire you. I want you then, after you've looked at all these, I want you to give me a call and tell me how it's going. How is your job search going? Wow. What? What kind of a contextual language? Wow. She's not working on a contextual language, no. Right? Not at all. Mm-hmm. So she does this. She gives the man the thing, and then she says to him, now, young man, if you really need money, I will give you money, but you're not going to take it from me. You're going to come with me to the bank, and I'll withdraw some money for you so that you can start on this job search. Wow. So he goes, he walks to the market with her, and he, as he's walking, he says to her, this doesn't sound like a real story, does it? He says to her, can I carry your bag for you?
Oh.
So here is the man who's been trying to hold her up, now is carrying her bag to the market. They go to the bank. She gives him the money, and then she goes on her way to keep marketing. And she notices he's still with her.
Yeah.
And she's getting her fruit, and he's still with her. And she finally turns and she says, why are you still here? And he said, well, I just wanted to be excused, if it's okay if I go.
Oh, my word.
What happened there?
Wow. Transformation.
Complete transformation, right? She didn't see him as another. She didn't see him as them. She didn't see him as, she saw this pericrit. Where's the need here? He's just like me. He's someone who has a shame response, and the only way he knows how to get what he needs is to take it. And that's why she said, you're not going to take this from me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give this to you. And then, of course, all I could think about was La Mis, which is exactly what the priest does, right? Things like that. So you can do that kind of thing. And from what I understand from Catherine, her mom did this often. This was not like a one-time thing.
But she wasn't being called up.
Yes, actually. Yes. So she must have lived in a very dangerous area. She said that gunmen came into their house several times.
Yeah, but I will say in Brazil that the people who are holding people up are not violent people. They just want something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So like when they hold you up, they'll tie you up and then they'll say, can I get you some water?
So, but there's one reason for that, right? Their culture is much more integrated relationally than we are. So the less independent you are, the more you're going to find that. But it just means that we've escalated things. So it doesn't mean we can't behave in the same way. I think that the idea that can happen should remind us that our first response to others is not to protect ourselves.
Interesting, I don't know if anyone watches Chicago Fire, but that was part of the storyline last night.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, very similar.
Interesting.
And they were all the other firefighters were really giving him trouble for, responding that way. And he said, like, we're called to help and give. No matter if we think someone deserves it or not. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, right in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, that's, now we're going to begin the lesson. That's where we ended last week, and I didn't get to tell you that story, because I thought, to me, that story just made a world of difference to see that it can work differently. So, if we are called to be intentionally vulnerable, pay attention, and seek attachment by asking for wisdom, we need to ask for wisdom in faith. That's where we left off. So what does that mean in faith? So faith is an integrated story. The word faith, I'm always reticent. And that's why I'm even reticent to say that one of the keywords of James is faith, because we have a connotation of faith that is not what James is working on. The definition of faith is, and if you've been in my class at all, you should be able to say this, a knowledge of, an assent to, and confidence such that produces fruit. I'll say it again three times. This is the definition of the Greek word pistis. A knowledge of, an assent to, and a confidence in such as produces fruit. In other words, I have a knowledge that this is a chair. I know that this is a chair. I agree that the chair is meant to be sat on. If I end there, I don't have faith. If I just say I believe this is a chair and I agree that it's useful to be sat on, if that's where I end, it's not faith. It's not biblical faith, right? Because it has to be, I have such a confidence that this is a chair and it's meant to be sat on, then I'm actually going to sit on it. Mm-hmm. That's the producing fruit. That's the integration that James is talking about. It can't just be, I believe this in my head. If it stays there, if it's not embodied, it's not faith. And it goes for the same thing when I'm asking for attachment with God. If I'm asking for his presence to show me how another way of being with another is, if I'm just asking for that and all I want is an answer for my problem, I'm not doing it in faith. I'm not actually sitting in what he's going to give me. I'm not saying that that's good enough, that that actually will work. It's this idea, it looks exactly like what a pericritic union looks like, right? I'm open to him filling me, I'm integrating him so that I'm fully known as well. So faith is an integrated story. Faith is not belief in information, an agreement of information even. It's got to be embodied. It's got to be actually in my body, walked out. I have to sit on this chair before I actually have faith that this is a chair to be sat on. So in faith is an integrated story. It's a receptive stance as well. The idea is it's not believing you're going to get your desires fulfilled. So this verse has been used for that often, right? Just believe what you want to get is going to happen and you're going to get it. It's not what it says. Mm-hmm. That is having your desires fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Because if you're open only to your desire getting fulfilled, you're not open, right? Mm-hmm. You just want this. Right. God, just give me the answer. Give it to me by 2:00 today. Tell me exactly what I want to do, what I have to do, and then I'll be off. What's the problem with that?
Gimme.
It's a transaction, and what happens to the relationship?
There really isn't.
Because all I really want from you is something you can give me that I can take away and go away, like this, right? Mm-hmm. That's not what God is saying here. That's not what James is saying here. When I ask for wisdom in faith, it's I actually trust that what God is going to give me in that perichoretic experience is going to be his full, naked, vulnerable self and his unashamed self. And that's going to be good and beautiful, and that what he gives me of himself will actually be this relationship where I get joy. And out of that joy, I'm all of a sudden free to be able to come up with specific ideas of what I can do with whatever I'm asking about. In other words, when I'm open to receiving God fully for what he wants to give me in relationship, it actually unlocks my ability to think in union with God about this problem. Rather than when I ask for a solution, I just want you to give me the solution so I can go and do it myself. Right? That's usually what we want. Just give me the... How many times do you say, God, just write it down on a piece of paper and I'll go do it. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. But the problem is, he doesn't want you to just go do it. He doesn't want you to have an... And this is why I'm so adamant when we talk about sin as behavior as sin. Mm-hmm. It's not about the behavior. It's about the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so if I miss that, if I keep on saying, oh, I just got an answer how to do something, and I go away and do it, God is very sad with that. Because you've gone away from him. Mm-hmm. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. So this receptive stance of God, give me, and that's why for me, I'm beginning this practice of I need to wake up and say, I would like an experience with you within your pericritic union of knowing how to be with others today. It switches my paradigm for the whole day, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of what I'm going to do, now it switches. Oh, it's about how I'm going to be with others. And, you know, thinking through, so now every interaction is about being with others rather than it is about getting something done. But in being with others and in being with God, there's this union of communication of, all of a sudden now I actually know what to do specifically in many instances. Not always, but many instances. So faith is an integrative story. It is a receptive stance. It also informs our own giving. So that when I have an integrated practice of faith, receptivity, it shapes how I give myself to others as well, fully and without strings attached. How many of you feel like you give yourself fully without strings attached to another? Yeah, that's not our typical. And part of that is because we're so attached to our contextual languages. And because when we ask, we're asking for ways to get our contextual languages fulfilled rather than for relationship.
We're also fearful.
But why are we fearful? Remember, fear, anger, criticism, that all comes from shame. Mm-hmm. All of it. So, faith is not a disintegrated story. It is an integrated story, but it's not a disintegrated story. And this is why he comes, James starts talking about doubt. We talked about doubt. So, this kind of doubt, remember, we talked about doubt in Lamentations, that there's nothing wrong with doubt, right? We talked about that. But what's the difference there in Lamentations than here? Do you remember what you're supposed to do with doubt in Lamentations? What did we learn about that?
Cry out to God.
Yeah, cry out to God, which is relationship, right? It's asking God for his presence. Here, James is saying the kind of doubt that we're talking about here is when I stand back from God and say, I stand outside of the context of working together with him. It's just what I said. I want an answer from you, God, and we'll see if your answer is good or maybe I have a better answer. Maybe it's better for me in this situation to think about life as being a battle that I need to win or as something I need to be good at rather than, so it's the standing back and judging. Which one's going to work this time? His way or my way? No, this can't be about relationship. It has to be about winning here. Make sense? So this, when James talks about doubting here, it's always a standing back and judging about which way is going to work better, my contextual language or God's language, relationship or getting what I want done here. So James says that kind of person shouldn't expect to receive. Why not? Because he doesn't have any desire to fully know God, right? There's no openness. He doesn't really want what he's asking for. He doesn't want relationship. He just wants something that will assure that his contextual language gets fulfilled. So he shouldn't expect to get that because that's not good for him, right? God doesn't want to give him what will fulfill his contextual language. So he shouldn't expect it because he's not open to getting wisdom. He's not open to getting the relationship that will bring the joy and the freedom to be able to creatively think with God. So a divided man doesn't really want mutual connection. That's what it means to doubt. I'm not sure which way is going to be better, but even if I doubt that God is good, and what I do with that is, God, I don't know if your way is good. God is like perked up his ears. You came to me about this. We can work on this together. We can, and rather than, I'm going to make a decision aside from you. So then he calls that kind of person a double-minded person. The word is actually double-souled. So you have two, it's like you have two souls, which is the antithesis, right, of the telos of God's language. The goal he has set for us is being fully known and fully knowing him. That's the telos of his language of connection. But a double-minded person's mind is not integrated. A double-minded person's is compartmentalized. I used to pride myself on being able to compartmentalize everything. I could just, in this situation, I can be like this. In this situation, I can be like this. And I prided myself in it because it helped me survive. What it did is it helped me avoid the pain, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what it did. And I felt like, wow, this is actually what I was It was a shame, another shame response. You compartmentalize. You can succeed in these different areas. That's double-minded, though. That's actually more than double-minded, right? That's triple-minded, and however many compartments you're having. And what happens physically in the brain if that happens? You become so unable to do life anymore. It becomes not complete. You're not integrated at all. The problem is, what you're doing there is questioning God's integrity. You're in questioning that he actually wants to give himself fully and that what he gives is good. So being double-minded, standing back and doubting, trying to decide between his language and my language is doubting God. It's doubting putting into question his integrity, whether he's fully integrated, whether his perichoretic relationship is actually life. We compartmentalize when we do things like this. God says this, but I don't know in this situation.
Yeah.
Because according to my experience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, do I dare bring up the refugee problem again? God says, take care of the orphan, the widow, and the refugee. He actually says that many times. But we gotta protect ourselves. Do you see that? That's double-minded. I believe what God says, and I want to do what God says. But when it comes to something bumping up against my contextual language, then I'm gonna reassess. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, at the very beginning of this issue coming up, I was very upset that very few Christians were standing up. All of a sudden, you start seeing a few here, a few here, a few here. Minus a couple that really irritate me, that are our representatives, that aren't willing to really stand up as Christians. This double-mindedness, this goes on all the time. And we live first as Americans and then as Christians. Mm-hmm. And God says, yeah, exactly, exactly. This double mind, and again, it goes back to these shame responses. All these shame responses bring up contextual languages, and you know, there's a big contextual language about being safe. That's life is all about being safe. Life is all about being healthy. All of these are contextual languages. We use lots of them, right? We have one particular one, but use lots of them. But here's the thing: so we individually have our contextual languages. But as a community, we have contextual languages as well. And that actually gets passed down just as much as our individual ones. So we have a communal contextual language that gets passed down, a communal shame response that gets passed down. And believe me, the more the more alike you are in a community, the more contextual language wall barriers you have. So that you'll find more, because you don't have people, others, right? You don't have others, Naperville, right? How many others are in Naperville? Not many. We're pretty much all the same. And you really stand out if you're not, right?
I see that with our students, it's really hard to decipher, what is true life as opposed to what
right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes, exactly. Very, very difficult to
especially
do that.
They have not gone out of those boundaries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And if they haven't gone out of those boundaries, particularly in a way that they are vulnerable. So this is what we do in Naperville churches. We have our kids go out to build homes for the mission field. But we don't go in as vulnerable. We go in as rescuers, right? So all we're doing is compounding that. We need to go vulnerable. Go in and be the minority who needs help. But are we willing to go to that place? That's a tough place to be. I don't know what's going on with that camera.
It's turned off.
Okay. Well,
what about the women's rights issue?
Yes. So we have lots of this, right? And as soon as we get into the poor world, we'll talk just briefly about that as well. But this is why James says, a double-minded person is like somebody who's tossed with the wind. Sometimes he's like, oh, yeah, what God says is great. This works well for me. But then sometimes we're like, yeah, this bumped into my contextual language, so yeah, maybe not. That is double-minded. That's like everything is good and kosher with what God says as long as it doesn't bump into my contextual needs, right? What I think is life.
My happiness.
My happiness, right? This is why one of the most things that irks me, and I've said it, is all I want is for my kids to be happy. Really? You just want them to live out their contextual languages? That's not life. So that's kind of what James is saying. And it's why trials are so necessary, because they allow us to have our contextual languages revealed. So our trials almost always reveal our contextual languages, where we're saying life is, because all of a sudden, like, oh, no. So for Catherine's mom, obviously her contextual language wasn't safety, because it didn't even bother her. What else went on in that interaction? I don't know. But for us, our first thought is, oh, I got to keep myself safe here, right? I got to keep myself safe. That I think that's a paradigm shift that we all right now are nodding. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then we're in that situation. That is so ingrained in us that our number one job is to keep ourselves safe. And that makes all the difference, right? It makes all the difference. That's not to say that you might actually encounter something and get hurt by it. It's not to say that. But I think there's somewhere that Jesus says, if you follow me, expect, right? Trials, persecution, you will.
When you go through.
Right, exactly.
Well, it's interesting, Jill, because there was the situation that probably people know about down the street here with the woman who was held up at gunpoint. And I said, last night, I said to my daughter, I looked her straight in the eye, and I said, now, you know, of course, if that ever happened to you, you give him whatever he wants, and you don't, and, you know, don't engage with him. And she kind of like, oh, okay, like, well, what would he, you know, maybe, you know, what, she was even hesitating, and I was telling her my contextual language of you be safe, and you don't engage, and you give them whatever they want, and you walk away, you know, it's just, it's not worth it, you know, it's not worth the car, or the money, or the keys, so.
Well, and so some of that, so we have, so it's not black and white, right?
Right.
Because saying all that's not worth it, that's true, right? It isn't true.
The stuff isn't true.
But when are we talking about relationship when that happens? When something, when you're encountering something that's putting you in danger, James is saying your first thought should be toward relationship. But yeah, where do we ever teach that?
Get rid of them as fast as possible.
Yeah. Right, right. So there's this, yeah, none of the stuff you have is important, but he is.
Well, the response that we're taught is fight or flight.
Right.
Nice. Yeah. Those are not relational.
Exactly.
But can I say something? And I don't mean to play the devil's advocate here.
No, do.
But like throughout the Old Testament, God gave such specific commands to set the people of Israel apart. Right?
Okay. So those who have been in a long time know the purpose of setting them apart was so that they would know that they're beloved and have that joy that would eventually go out. Okay, right. So that was for a time. Mm-hmm. It's basically in Hosea, they call it the honeymoon period, right? It's a honeymoon period, so you and I get to know each other and you get the joy of connection. Mm-hmm. And that connection was to go out. They weren't going out, and therefore they ended up actually
being dispersed.
Right. Mm-hmm. So remember, Old Testament, New Testament, remember it's a progression, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't tell the whole story from Leviticus, but you can tell the whole story from Genesis all the way through. Mm-hmm. You've got to see the whole story.
But I thought with people of Israel, when I think of the temple and how when you build a temple, it's not like walls, there's openings.
Yep.
So that people could engage.
Correct. Yes, correct. So that was down there, the road, right?
Oh, okay.
So first, I'm setting you apart so that you know I've chosen you. He's basically retelling his story from Genesis 1, right? I love you. I've chosen you. You're special. You're going to work with me. Now, be like me. Start to open up those. He doesn't expect us to be fully integrated tomorrow. But open up the door. Open up one door today, and open up another. So it kind of goes on like that. Yeah. So, in order for us to integrate then our story with God's story, we need to remember that his story is our story. It's not Satan's story that's our story. It's God's story that's our story. But it will be a process. It will take us learning to long for his story to be embedded in us. And in doing so, it is always going to shift our paradigms. We have been raised in, we have had it affirmed and confirmed that our contextual languages are what life is. So there's going to be paradigm shift as to what life looks like, and a paradigm shift about what not to avoid and what to avoid. All of our contextual languages basically say avoid pain, right? Mm-hmm. At all costs, avoid pain. Because remember, the contextual languages come out of shame, and shame is that possible, the worst pain we can have is abandonment. As a human being, the worst pain we can have is abandonment, and we're trying to protect against that, the possibility of abandonment. So if we want to integrate God's story with our story, we're going to have to understand that avoidance of pain is actually not part of the process. Pain produces life. Where do you know that to be true? Which is why for the rest of James, he uses that metaphor. So from here on in, James's metaphor will always be going back to pain produces life. Because it's going to be a pain to come face to face with the possibility that you could be abandoned. Because in knowing the possibility that you could be abandoned, you'll actually experience the fact that God's love is everlasting, that he doesn't abandon you. But I won't know that, right? If I'm always avoiding the connection. So I need to recognize God's story in the concrete. And this is where James is like down on the ground, on the earth. We're going to talk about rich and poor. Because the rich and poor are this beautiful idea of you're going to have to change your paradigms about what you think is life and what you think isn't life. And remember the kind of context that James is in. It was a very out there, obvious, it's a shameful thing to be poor. It's an honoring thing to be rich. You can't be an honest person unless you're rich. You're absolutely a they, a them, a horrible person if you're poor. It was right out there. We live in the exact same society. We just don't admit it. It is a shame to be poor, and it's an honor to be rich. That is our paradigm as well. We just never would say that. Well, I shouldn't say never. We're beginning to actually be much more upfront about that, I think. But I think in the church we would not say that. I think that would be hard for us to say. So what James does is he shows the fact that the life that is necessary in a poor person's life and the life that's necessary in a rich person's life, or the life that happens in a rich person's life, are actually shifting paradigms. So those who are poor, and I still have a hard time. I know Lisa doesn't want me to use that word poor, but I'm going to use it here. James uses it. The one thing they have to practice by necessity is mutual dependence. They have to practice it. They have to be dependent. and they have to be dependent on others while at the same time not being satisfied with how this world's order is happening. In other words, the disorder of the world. They are not satisfied with that. They're very dissatisfied with that. And that's a good thing, guys. We should never say, well, you shouldn't be so dissatisfied with how things are. Because how things are disordered. And they're not for everyone to be us, and they're not for connection. That's not the order of this world. And because they're not satisfied with the order of this world, they're always looking for God's order to come. So, obviously, are all poor people looking for God's order to come?
No.
Well, let's say maybe they don't know that's what they're looking for, but they are looking for an order that's different,
yeah,
that is actually equality for everyone, right? That's actually seeing everyone as us. Absolutely everyone is looking for that. Are the rich looking for that, though?
No.
No, actually, the world's order works well for them. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, right? And that's why God says, look, I'm looking at the poor because that's what the kingdom's going to look like. People who want a different order, who are looking to be mutually dependent, that's part of life. Now, it doesn't mean that the poor like being poor. It just means that they're actually practicing what the kingdom life is going to look like, a mutual dependence. They're having to do it by necessity, but in the kingdom, it'll be done because we want it. The rich are not doing that. The rich are going to be humbled because they're not learning the skills of the kingdom. They're actually going about, when it talks about, so it says, for the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass and its flower falls off and the beauty of the appearance is destroyed, so too the rich man, in the midst of his pursuits, will fade away. That's the key part of that verse there, in the midst of his pursuits. What James is saying is, the rich man goes about doing what he does without any concern for how his life affects others. I'm just going about, this world works for me. I know how to use it for my best. I know how to get my contextual languages fulfilled. And I don't even think about what that does for others. What James is calling us to see is the poor are practicing the way the kingdom's going to work. The rich are getting no practice in that as a whole. But that we as the church are called to be sensitive to the pain that is being suffered in the poor communities, because they're suffering under shame, huge amounts of shame, right? Because they're looked upon as not enough in our society, right? You pass someone who has smelly clothes on, who obviously hasn't had a shower in a while, and we look at them as, right? We do. I had to laugh. I would have been with you when Lissa was talking and asking you, so describe the poor. Mm-hmm. And everyone was, at the beginning, giving nice answers, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I could see Lissa going, oh, brother.
Yeah.
That's not what you really think. What you really think is they're smelly. Mm-hmm. They're lazy. They're all of that, right? Mm-hmm. That's... James is saying you need to look at them. You need to have an empathy for them. You need to be in their shoes. And you're not going to get there unless you know your own shame responses, right? Because the shame responses, not just individual shame responses, and here's with the poor, it's the communal shame responses have actually not just put, and this is, at some point I wanted Lisa to talk about this, the structural society has actually made sure that the poor stay poor, the way that we've structured society. They are feeling not enough, therefore they experience disconnection, and as a result of disconnection, they lack physical needs. Now I want you to think about this. What does God say the purpose of him giving wealth is?
To bless others.
To bless others, to share. That is the purpose of giving wealth. When God gives us wealth, the purpose is to share. When I'm disconnected, when they're a them, I don't share. They're now suffering shame because I am not sharing and seeing in us, in them. So do you see that how I live affects how other people live, right? So that's what James is talking about here. They go about and they live their lives and they go do, and I shouldn't say they, right? We go about our lives and we don't think about what we do affecting others. Even the ways that we buy. Boy, I don't know what lesson we had about this, but we talked a lot about how we buy things. Like we're always, we want to get the best deal, right? Mm-hmm. So we're really good at transactions. And remember, transactions is always about how do I get the best deal? Not thinking about when I get the best deal, how does that affect somebody else down the line? And it always does. It always affects somebody else. But we don't think about that even in our spending habits. What James wants us to know with the rich and the poor. So he's always going to use the rich and poor. That's his context. It's our context as well. Karen, you had said, what about women's rights? I think when we talk about who are the rich and the poor in our society, it's not just those who have a low income. Because when you have less money, you have less power. So it's also the people who have less power, right? So then we're going to talk about not just those who have less income, but those who have a different skin color, those who are different gender, right? I mean, women are going to be seen less because they have less power. And when you have less money in a society, you have less power. When you have less power, you have less ability to be known fully. And that's where it comes down to, right? If you have less ability to be known fully, that's you're disconnected with society. In James' society, the ones who were fully known all out there were the rich, but not the poor. In fact, remember I told you the reason that Rome came down on the Christian sect out of Judaism was because they were wanting the poor to be known. Look, these people need this. Well, what are you doing? We don't need to know about that. And we do the same here, right, when those kind of issues come up. Those aren't important issues. The important issue is, I think last night the big news thing was, I don't remember where it is, somewhere in the suburbs, about the $8 million school they're going to be building. And people decided, oh, maybe we need to back off. It's Hinsdale or Elmhurst, one of the two. Oh,
Hinsdale is building a new middle school.
That's what it is. Yeah. And people are like, oh, we've got to get this built. And the newscaster said, could you, why does this need to be built so badly?
Because it's old. The school is old and our students need better.
We're not considering, obviously there's lots of this. So when we talk about the fact that I think sometimes people say politics should be separate from religion, and then you go, that's disintegration. Everything is informed by what we say. So the rich and the poor should teach us to long for the kingdom order on the structural scale, on the social scale, not just in our own lives, but on the big scale as well. And it should ask us to reexamine our community-instilled stories of poverty, what we think poverty looks like. And those get instilled by the stories that we listen to. I don't care what news you listen to. If you listen to CNN or you listen to Fox, they're telling you one perspective. And that perspective, especially if you listen to it over and over again, is going to become an embodied story for you, and that's what you'll believe about a certain group of people. Either side is going to be that. I have stories I could read you that tell you, oh, this is what it's like to have this policy. And you go, oh, yeah. But then if you've never heard that side, you go, oh, I've never heard that side. Well, because you've had an embodied story repeated to you through the community. Does that make sense? So now it's not just what happened in your family of origin, but what's happening in your community that you live in, which is another reason why it's so important for us to get out of our community, to not just have friends that are white evangelical rich people. I don't know how to say that more poignantly. I want to be careful not to go over here.
Can I just add, this is a bit convicting in this poverty vision, because I spent the weekend with my parents, and they're in an independent living of a retirement village, but are having a harder time taking care of a few basic needs. And so much of the conversation when we were there, other people would say, you're so lucky you have people. And our purpose kind of was, for being there, was to make it appear that they're okay. And building up this wall so that others don't know that they're not as okay as they look. And, you know, they are distancing themselves. They eat just the two of them, because others might know, others might see that there's a crack in this. And, there are a lot of contextual languages for them coming up and for myself. And I think the way we deal with aging is another poverty.
Oh, totally.
Yes.
That is hard.
That's good. That's really hard, isn't it?
That's
really hard.
Was at the doctor's office on Monday and couldn't get any more free samples of the medication that I have to be on until the end of April. So he wrote me a prescription. He says, you have a choice here. You can go back to the old kind where you have to stab your fingers every 3 days and you have to not eat any green veggies. And they keep regulating it, or I can write you one for the prescription. So I cried. I just cried. He says, well, I have to go see another patient. I can't get here and wait while you're crying. He says, think it over, but you need to make this decision because I have to write your prescription now because you have only 4 pills left. That's only 2 days. I'm crying. So I said, well, you know, what do I do, God? So I said, all right, write the prescription. And hopefully you'll get some more free ones before this prescription runs out. If not, then I have to face this thing all over again. And I decided yesterday that I'll take the cheaper thing or else just stop. And he says, you can't just stop. But anyway, I went and got the prescription filled, and the copay was $205 for a month's supply, $205. And I had written to the company and said, I can't afford this. And so I had a card that made the copay only $10. But that's only if you're not on Medicare and you don't have a prescription plan that goes with Medicare. So us poor old people that are on Medicare and have a prescription plan that goes with we can't get this expensive drug for $10 a month. But somebody who has a commercial plan or a plan with their employer, they can.
That
get that
sense.
For $10. And I thought, what
that
is this?
Sense.
You know, who needs this more? The people who have a big insurance plan from a company? Or us poor old folks that are on Medicare and have no choice? So I paid the $205. And so I have pills for a month from now. And then I guess I'll go have my fingers pricked and go back to the other, because it's cheaper. I have no idea how cheap is cheaper. It may only be $100.
Maybe mail order.
Well, yeah. That's cheaper. Get it from India or Pakistan or somewhere.
And I think it is important for us to, what Linda brought up, what Pat's bringing up is, we have in our midst the poor, but the aging, there's all sorts of ways. Remember that James focuses others, always. It's always the focus on others. So I think for us to keep that in mind, that it's about others rather than about doing. This is the video I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you Father Greg again. I could listen to him all day. For those of you who haven't been in our class for a while, Father Greg is a priest who decided that he felt God was calling him to live amongst the gangs, the worst gangs in the nation, in L.A., and minister to them and give them worth. And that's what he does. He gives them worth. So why I want to show you this one is because we think about, oh, there are people like Father Greg and Mother Teresa and Mama Maggie and these many people that do it right. So they don't have any problems with, you know, choosing relationship over. And Father Greg, I mean, honestly, he just amazes me. But I think this will show you that, you know, we all struggle with this.
I'm in 25 different detention facilities where I say mass Catholic services in all the probation camps, juvenile halls, youth authorities.
You can turn off the...
And usually on a Saturday, you know, I will do two masses in Las Afueras in the boonies, and then I race back to Dolores Mission because I have so many, you know, things. I've been there for 25 years, and the homies ask me to do stuff. So my Saturday always looks sort of the same. 1 o'clock baptism, and 2 o'clock quinceañera when a girl turns 15, and 3 o'clock wedding, 4 o'clock exorcism. Just checking to see if you're still listening to me. I've never done one of those, but anyway, so I reached home one day and it's 20 minutes to one, and I thought, well, I'm going to go to my office and I'm going to go through my mail all by myself. So I go there and there I am, contento, feliz, when all of a sudden a woman barges into my office. I find out her name is Lisa. She's 34 years old. This is the first time she's ever stepped foot in my office. Oh, everybody knows her. They've seen her around. She's kind of a famous street person, prostitute, heroin addict, gang member, tattooed, felon. She's something of a famous peleonera and a gritona. She's always fighting. She's always screaming. You can hear her scream as she gets tossed out daily from the bar next door. You can hear her scream into a payphone on First Street, just let me stay tonight, pleading with family members and friends. And this is the first moment she's ever stepped foot in my office. And now it's 7 minutes to one. She comes in, she plunks herself down, she launches right in. I need help. Ooh, I've been to like 50 rehabs. I'm known all over, nationwide. Went to Catholic schools all my life, she says. Graduated from elementary. Graduated from Sacred Heart High School in Lincoln Heights. And then she gets quiet and still. And she says, in fact, first time I ever used heroin was right after I graduated. And I've been trying to stop since the moment I began. And I watched as she leaned her head against the wall behind her, and her eyes became like two ponds, water rising to meet its edges and spilling over. And she cried and she cried, till finally she leveled her eyes at me, and she said with great deliberation, I am a disgrace. And suddenly, her shame meets mine, because when I had seen her step into my office that afternoon, I had mistaken her for an interruption. Mm-hmm. We're in this together. Kinship, only kinship. The measure of our compassion lies not in our service of those on the margins, but only in our willingness to see ourselves in kinship with them. For we do not seek a compassion. The compassion of Jesus is the one we seek, the one that can stand in awe at what the poor have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it. In the early days, years ago, in our first office, a bunch of kids coming home to the projects from middle school and elementary school, they'd all come in, and one of the kids was a kid named Bendito. And Bendito was a little 12-year-old kid who, English was not his first language, but he always insisted on speaking English with me, even though he'd operate.
You know, I'm going to stop just because we're getting time. I wanted you to hear that story. Yeah. That even Father Greg, whose business, whose life is all about relationship, forgets sometimes that it's not the doing, getting his things done. But there's people. And when did it change for him in that instant? you hear what he said?
When she was ashamed.
And he said, when my shame met hers. Mm-hmm. You see why it's so important for us to understand our shame responses and our shame stories? Because it's the place that we'll meet other people, as human beings. We need to understand that. And that's where James is coming from when he talks about rich and poor. He's really getting down to that point that God's paradigm looks completely different than ours. He looks at people. And, I mean, you can just hear his voice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when he talks about someone else's hardships, his voice just cracks. And you know that he has that. And I love the fact that he says, my shame meets hers. And you want to say, your shame? What shame do you have? But see, every one of us has it. And if we don't work into it, we don't see and meet others' shames. So that's first paradigm that James wants to switch for us. The second is that trials are a blessing. Because the telos of trials is connection with others. Trials actually mature our faith. They actually integrate our being better, because first of all, they strengthen intimacy. They give us an opportunity to cling to relationship within the trial. If we stay there, if we don't stay in the trial, if we try to get rid of this trial now, then we miss the opportunity to connect. Catherine's mom, she would have missed the opportunity to connect if she just said, here, take my bag and go, right? But now, my guess is, I would love to go talk to Catherine and ask, my guess is, I bet you any money these people are friends. I bet Catherine's mom and this man who tried to hold her up mm-hmm. have some kind of relationship, right? Mm-hmm. There was a connection there, and the man was not the only one who got something out of that. But her mom did as well. Mm-hmm. So trials actually give us the opportunity to connect with others and with God. And in fact, what James says is, those who endure are those who love the Lord. It's not like the only people who endure are because it is because they love the Lord. It is because there's a connection that they stay in the trial. The joy of relationship is what keeps them in the trial. The joy for, I wish I knew Catherine's mom's name. The joy of Catherine's mom's trial was the joy of relationship there, right? That's why she stayed there. That's why she touched the man and helped the man and conversed with the man. I mean, why do parents sacrifice for their children? Because of the connection they have with them, right? It's sometimes it looks like we sacrifice because we want them to reflect how great we are as a parent. Sometimes we fall into that trap. But most of the time, we sacrifice for them because we just love having them in our lives, right? And we want to be able to continue that. It's out of that joy. He goes on to say that, this is verse 12, that those who persevere in trial receive the crown of life. And I know when we read that, we're thinking reward. What James is trying to say here is the reward of a trial is the crown, but the crown is actually the relationship. So it's the relationship in there that is the crown. That's what you receive. It's not this tangible thing that says you did good. It's a relationship. Listen to Paul. Paul says, therefore, my brothers and sisters, you whom I love and long for, you are my joy and crown. And he says it again in Thessalonians. For what is our hope, our joy, or our crown, in which we glory in the presence of the Lord Jesus when he comes? Is it not you? So when we think about crown in the scriptures, in fact, I think we've talked about this before. In Revelation, it talks about the fact that we'll be able to put our crowns before the Lord, right? That will be our thing. And I'll bet that when you think about that in your head, you're thinking about all the things you accomplished for God. because we talk about the, how many jewels do you have in your crown? I remember as a little kid, mm-hmm. they used to tell, you know, oh, that's a jewel in your crown. James says, and Paul says, your crown is the relationships, the vulnerable, integrated relationships. That's what you get to put at the feet of Jesus, because that's what he cares about. And that is a gift that he is overjoyed at. Here, you get to put in the vulnerable relationships. That's what we worship God with, is the vulnerable relationships, the places where we have been vulnerable to let ourselves be fully known and to fully know another. That's the crown that's received in a trial. When you stay in the trial, you end up out of that a great relationship. There are a couple instances I can think of that are examples. When I was first getting to know, so when I was teaching Bible study, boy, probably 20 years ago, and my classes were big, and they were in the church, and so I got an administrator like Robin does, and she did my administration, and she and I were very different. You know, I was always, you know, I looked good, I was always dressed well, and she was like, I could care less what I look like, and all of these things, but she was my administrator. But we found that we had something in common. We both love gardening. And so she had grown up on a some of you know this woman. She had grown up on a peony farm, and mm-hmm. it was still in the family. So she said, one day we should go out to the peony farm and dig up some peonies. So we went there, and we started. And she doesn't know me well yet, and I don't know her well yet. And we started digging peonies, and a thunderstorm. Mm-hmm. So we're in the middle of this field, and a thunderstorm comes. And we'd taken her little truck into there, and it is a mess. And we just start laughing. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. And we're like, we're not going to stop. It's just raining. So we dig in the mud. I mean, we are mud, head to toe. And we're going to get as many peonies. So most of the peonies in my yard are from that trip. And we get these, and then we put them in the truck, and we start to go, and is stuck in the mud. There's no way we're getting this out. And so, of course, she had to call her husband, which was a tough thing. It's like, okay, you have now to come out to Joliet and do this. Anyway, that out of that produced this friendship that was huge. And she said, I always thought you were prissy. I just never thought that you would. But see, it was in a trial that we found out. If it wouldn't have started raining, we would have gotten, you know, the peonies done well, and that would have been that. It was the trial that actually cemented us to, like, oh no, we're both, yeah, we're both the same. We might look differently on the outside, but we're both the same. Another very similar situation was when a friend of mine had a fire, and this was Cheryl Enderline, who was here for many years. I didn't know her at the time, but I was at the time kind of her pastor. I was the head of women's ministry, so she had a fire in like her whole townhouse. It was just horrible. And I said, well, I'll come over and help you. Now, she didn't know me, but I came over and helped her. And if any of you've had a fire, it's actually a very vulnerable thing, because I came over to help her go through all of her stuff. So this is showing me, you know, your whole life without knowing me. That cemented a relationship that has been super amazing for both of us. And we are not alike in hardly any way. We don't have hardly anything in common. And yet it was the trial that actually cemented the relationship. And so that when we think back on the fire, that was like, oh, that was the beginning of our friendship. So see, it's trials that actually bring relationships, which are the crown. That's the crown of life, is you getting to participate in life itself. And I think sometimes we forget that that's what life is about, and it's what James is trying to tell us about. So it's not this... James is not talking about a race that you're entering to win at all costs and excluding everyone else. It's entering into life, into a participation into life. You're not winning salvation. That's not what James is talking about here. You're actually winning life. You're actually, we all get to participate in life through that. It's not things you accumulate through any of your getting your contextual languages fulfilled. In fact, seeing vulnerable relationship as the reward actually goes against all of your contextual language, the telos of all of your contextual language. Because every one of our contextual languages says, we get a reward that says, you are valuable because you did something. And then God says, oh, actually the reward is relationship. It's nothing to do with what you did. It has everything to do with how you related.
Which is funny, I mean, because when you think about it, I mean, that's what your workplace is all about. Mm. It's like, well, we're going to give you this because...
Right, right. I mean, that's how the world works, right? That's how it works. And yet, we can go into the world and not have that language. So we can go in and we can get a paycheck that says you did a good job. But if we go into work and it's about relationship, mm-hmm. it changes everything, right? Mm-hmm. So most of you know Betty Hum that used to be here. I don't know anybody who is better than that. Going into any place, sometimes it was hard to go with her places because it was all about relationship. Mm-hmm. This whole James, I hear her little voice like, Jill, it's all about relationship. It's all about relationship. And I'm like, yeah, Betty, yeah, sometimes, but not always. For her, it was always about relationship. And man, that took much longer to do everything.
Yeah.
But I imagine her crown is just huge. She probably has this great crown there. So what trials do is teach us to long for the kingdom order on a personal scale. But it also asks us to re-examine our personal stories of trials as punishment mm-hmm. or trials as something to get through so we can get on with life. That's actually instilling in us the opportunities for relationship. Sin does bring trial, but the purpose of the trial is not to punish. And it's not to say, it's to bring your attention back to connection. Trials always are meant to bring your attention back to connection. It's not intended to make you feel worthless. Mm-hmm. Because only an unloving father would want you to feel worthless. God wants you to feel valued. And trials are part of the way that he actually does that. Because you feel valued when you find those relationships. So, it's an integration process. It begins by being open to others, being vulnerable to God's life, giving himself fully to that. I really hate this watch. you have to tap on it to give it the time. So, if we're going to recognize God's story in the concrete, we're also going to need to recognize Satan's story in the concrete. And so James begins to talk about temptations. So in 13, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God. So here he's going to say, you've got to be able to concretely recognize what Satan is trying to tell you and trying to do with you. First of all, it's going to be the antithesis of God's story, right? God doesn't tempt us to find another language. So temptation is always going toward another language, right? Finding another language. God's never going to do that. Because God has no desire for such a life, for a life that isn't about relationships. So he's not going to desire that for his children, for anyone. So we can't blame God for bringing us temptation. He's never going to say, I'm bringing you this so that you might look at another way of living. That's Satan's story, to take our attention away from his secure attachment. So, temptation is a focus on fulfilling your desire. It's a focus on fulfilling your desire. Now, that's going to be a paradigm shift for us, because our culture, our society, and our families tell us that is what life is about, fulfilling your desire. Every commercial you watch, that's the point of a commercial. You need this, you need to get it. This is how you can get it fulfilled, right? That's when we say to our family, I just want you to be happy. That's what we're saying. I just want you to be able to fulfill your desires. That is our paradigm. So for us to say that temptation is actually a focus on fulfilling your desires, we're nice Christians and we're all going to nod, yeah, that's true. That's a tough one. For us to say that's temptation, that that's actually to fulfill our desires is leading us away from connection with God. So James delineates that but each of you is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. This kind of surprised me. This process of disintegration for Satan. So it's going to look like how God's process of integration is, but it's going to be disintegration. So it's going to be just the opposite, but it's going to look like it. First, it's inattention to my emotions. So it's inattention to my emotions as warning. Because remember, my emotions, my anger emotion, my desire to lash out, my desire to be critical, those things are an emotion that's there for a warning. That connection, you're starting to look away. That's what temptation does. It actually, you're not paying attention to that. It distracts you, right? So it carries you away. Carry away means to draw attention away. Draw attention away from God's secure attachment. Remember when I made that loud noise, like a baby would do that. So any small thing that might draw our attention away from secure attachment is part of temptation's process. Enticed means to be allured into thinking there's a different or better way of life. So we go back to the garden. Satan says, look at the tree here. Look, there's good stuff there. Oh, there's a different, I could take life instead of waiting for it to be given. For me to receive it, I could just take it. That's a different way I could actually make up my own life. But what I'm most intrigued about, it says all of this, you're carried away and you're enticed by what?
Lust.
Your lust. What do we think about lust meaning?
Sexual.
Yeah, right? We do think that. And that makes it really safe for most of us, right? Don't have a problem with lust.
Just like murder.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. Until Jesus says, if you hate in your heart. Right. What makes us susceptible to actually being open to a story about living to fulfill our desires? It's lust. This is the definition of lust. I did not make this up. It's an active and individual desire resulting from wounding. It's shame. It is an active and individual desire resulting from wounding. That's what lust is. That's a really different, isn't it? Why do you think we've kind of compartmentalized lust into sexual over desire?
So we don't own it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Oh, I don't have a problem with that. So, you know, I'm not tempted by lust. But boy, go back to that, what the Greek means, and you're like, oh, an individual and active desire resulting from wounding. In other words, my shame responses, my way of avoiding pain, my way to say, there's got to be a different way of life because I don't want the possibility of abandonment. It's avoiding pain. Lust is an individual way of doing life so that I can avoid pain. And don't tell me that not every one of us does that, right? We all have an individual way of doing life so that we avoid the most pain as possible. Those are our contextual languages. That's what lust is. So now that changes it, right? Completely.
Can you give an example? Is that sexual, the lust thing? I'm having trouble.
Okay, good.
Well, this is going to sound really bad, but like I call myself, well, this is going to sound really bad, but kind of bringing it into like the sexual overtone, but it's not. Like I call myself a shoe whore, and I love shoes, so I lust after them. Mm-hmm. But I actually call myself that. But wait, it's really bad to call myself that. And I've stopped because I really have stopped buying them. But I lust after shoes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would be the difference between lust and coveting them?
nothing.
Oh.
But lust covers it all. Lust covers any time I'm going after my contextual language. So if my contextual language is I want to be good, mm-hmm. So now this puts it really weird, right? Mm-hmm. I want to be good. To be good means I'll have life. So I could lust after I'm gonna be the head of three ministries, mm-hmm. so that I look good. Mm-hmm. That's lust.
Shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of like what you're looking for.
Exactly. It is a longing for you to get life on your own, mm-hmm. and it not be about vulnerable, connected relationships.
It's like the independent versus dependent.
Absolutely. That's exactly it.
I mean, it could even be not being vulnerable in a sexual relationship.
Yes.
You know, so really.
Exactly.
Like
right.
Turning it around.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's funny because we actually will bring that into focus a little bit more later. So that's another reason we need to know our shame stories. It's essential for our healing to pay attention to what our shame stories are because it's lust. Our shame stories and the way that we employ contextual languages is lust.
I don't know if you've talked about this, John. I apologize if you have. And I know it's from Game of Thrones, like where they say shame, shame, shame. But there was a town hall meeting and everybody stood up and they were going, shame. Shame, because they wouldn't let them speak.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right.
The
congressman,
is that one?
It might have been. Yeah. And they just sat there and said that.
Yeah. That. So to know our shame responses that come up, that make us employ contextual languages, help us to see where our lust is. Those places that we're tempted to look at life not as relationship. To look at life as something is about being good, is about being right, is about being smart, is about being
in control.
Mm-hmm. All of those are lust. And that's essential for us to know. Because if we know that, then we'll begin to look at sin very differently, right? Instead of sin being disconnection, which it is, we'll look at sin as behavior. And God wants us to pull back and go, no. We were talking about this in class last night, and people who read that shame book said, I never thought about Adam and Eve's sin coming before she actually ate the apple. I'm like, oh, yeah. And that's what we don't think, right? We think as long as we don't eat the apple, we're fine.
We can hold it and admire it.
Right, exactly.
Touch it.
Yeah, exactly. But to think that there's another way of life other than relationship with God and connection with others is always going toward temptation. And then he says, and he talks about what's happening there. So remember, since this is the opposite of integration, it's inattention. And what's, if we're going to be integrated, it's attention, what?
Well,
attachment.
Need attachment.
Yes. Yes. So vulnerability, attention, and attachment. So in sin, you're not vulnerable. You're not open to what God has to give you. You want just what you want. You're inattentive to his warnings, right, through your emotions. You don't take them as warnings. So because you're not attentive to them as warnings, you know what you do with your emotion? You attach to them. So now you have a disordered attachment. You attach to your emotion rather than a person. In other words, all right, something happens terrible to you and you're really upset. What do you say?
I'm angry.
I am angry. Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
I am angry.
Instead of no. I am feeling angry.
Yes.
You're a priest.
I am a priest and I do feel angry. But I am angry. And we say it over and over and over again. We begin to attach ourselves to our emotion rather than heeding it as a warning. I am angry. And it becomes who I am. Now, physiologically, how long does it take for the emotion of anger to flip through your brain?
90 seconds.
It takes 90 seconds for that emotion to be a warning. So anger comes flitting through. It's the rail gates, the flashing lights. 90 seconds that happens. After 90 seconds, physiologically, after 90 seconds, you choose whether to heed it as a warning or to take that gate off and hold on to it. So think about coming to a railroad crossing. Mm-hmm. The gates go down. Warning, warning, they're only going to be there 90 seconds. And after 90 seconds, you got to decide whether you're going to heed them and just stop or take those gates off and hold on to them. And that's what happens with anger. You get those choices to stop and heed as a warning or to take it and it becomes part of who you are. I am angry. This is my gate. It's not going to stop me from what I want. Remember, anger is there to stop you from going towards disconnection. Mm. Those emotions, those anger emotions, and for you it might be judgment or critical or those types of emotions, those are all there not for you to attach to, but to heed. But for Satan, he brings these and we just go right along with it. Oh, I'm not going to pay attention to my emotion as what it is. I'm going to take it and it's going to be mine. So I practice then identifying with the warning emotion, with lust. And I integrate it into my own identity. And when I do that, when I practice taking that in, and I practice, eventually it conceives. It actually creates then more anger. Right? You know that, right? Mm-hmm. You take anger and you make it yours and you nurture it. You actually tend to it in a way that it isn't supposed to be tended to. And you give it more and more ability to grow, and now you have more anger, and now it's the practice of your life. That every time your contextual language gets bumped up against, you get angry. And why do you get angry? Because anger is actually a violation of your will. You have noticed that your will is being violated, and you're angry. And when I talk about your will being violated, I'm talking about your contextual language. It just got bumped up against, and I am not going to have that. I am going to hold on to anger, and it's going to become who I am, so that it becomes your story. I should be angry because I didn't get what I wanted. And with that, disintegration occurs. You give birth to a life of disconnection, right? Anger always disconnects, right? Once it's birthed, once it becomes this practice. Anger, remember, is supposed to be a warning for you to stop. You're going toward disconnection. If you keep it as yours and you make that's who I am, you create disconnection. And what happens with disconnection is that it always reaches its telos. Disconnection's telos is death. When I look to have my desires as the focus instead of self, I have self-focus instead of others' focus, I am now dysfunctional. Right? What did we say in Genesis? Genesis, we're created with this great joy that we can function as image bearers who name and tend and give space. When I allow a contextual language other than relationship to be the language of what life is, I eventually become dysfunctional. In other words, I am having a very hard time naming worth in somebody else, tending somebody else, and making space for someone else. So that when I sin, when I disconnect, when I choose disconnection as a way of life, it affects people around me. Because I'm not able to be the priest who names worth in them, who tends, right? When is the hardest time for you to name worth in someone? When you're angry, right? Or when you have somehow put a wall between you and someone else, right? That's the hardest time. So dysfunctioning image bearers cannot name and tend and make space. And if the telos of my story isn't connection, then I'm deceiving myself into thinking it will make me whole. Let me get 2 points down and we'll end there. What this does for us when we see Satan's story in the concrete is that it teaches us to hate disorder on the structural level, right? We should hate people killing other people. We should hate people stealing and destroying others' property. We should hate that people ridicule and disrespect others. We should hate that. That's when we see Satan's story in the concrete, it makes us hate the disorder on the structural scale, on the big scale in society, what happens. But then it asks us to re-examine our communal stories of a primary right to fulfill our own desires. Let me say that again, because I want you to think about that. We need to re-examine our communal stories of a primary right to fulfill our own desires. We've said this before. Originally, the Bill of Rights says we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The original meaning of happiness was moral conduct for the common good. Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's what the Bill of Rights says. But when we say it today, what do we mean? Fulfill our own desires. That's what we mean by that now. Yeah. But hear me out. Listen to this carefully. If that's true, if we want to fight in this country to let everyone be able to do whatever makes them happy in their own home, what we're doing is establishing a practice of self-fulfilling desires, self-focus. And if we're purporting that that's a good way, everybody should be able to fulfill their own desires in their own homes the way they want to, what we do then is we are growing communities where everyone is out for themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's not a no threatening for the society. When I say, you should be able to do whatever you want in your own home. When I say that, I am saying that life should be about you filling desires. And if I'm saying that for everyone doing it individually in their home, then I'm saying society should look that way too. Because it will look that way, even if I don't think so. If I say, well, it's just your private stuff, it always leaks out. And it always comes into a society, right? So that society now is about a whole society, about everyone getting what they want for themselves. What does a society look like where it's all about getting for yourself?
Disorder.
Complete chaos. You can't have a society that actually works that way. It doesn't exist. It falls apart. So when we purport that it's a good idea for everyone should have the right to be able to follow their own desires in their own homes, we're actually saying that's what should happen in society. Does that make sense? Do you see how that leads to that? So it teaches us to hate that on a social scale, but then also to hate that on a personal scale as well. Because my sin, my practice of saying yes to those things that support this expansion of living in your contextual languages, actually, when I say yes to focusing on my desires, I'm buying in and supporting the foundation of life as being all about me. Mm-hmm. And if I'm supporting that in here, in my life, then I'm supporting that everywhere else as well. And so that grows into the types of sins that you can't ignore: killing, exploiting others. So your personal desire to fulfill your contextual languages actually has a bigger impact than you think, a much bigger impact. And it is social. It is structural. It becomes that. So both ways, we need to hate both ways that life is about fulfilling your desires, making you happy. We've got to be able to stand up as Christians and say, that's not what life is about. Mm-hmm. Life is about relationship. And in relationship, you will find God doesn't care about our happiness, but he does care about our joy. And joy only comes from those integral, vulnerable relationships, not from you fulfilling your contextual languages. I want us to confess. I want us to remember that as we go to confession, that God is a merciful God, that all of us are in this place, and that we have great joy of being able to connect with him in those places of vulnerability. So I want you to take 1 minute, be quiet before the Lord, and ask him for those places that you're actually following your lust, that you're allowing lust to be a practice in your life of fulfilling your own contextual languages. Most merciful God, we confess that we are sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry and we humbly repent. For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and forgive us. That we may delight in your will and walk in your ways to the glory of your name. Amen. Thank you, ladies.